Hello, this is Science Extra from The Guardian. I'm Alok Jha. This is the full interview with friend of the Science Pod, Raymond Tallis, who, as well as being a professor of geriatric medicine at the University of Manchester, is a philosopher and a poet. Vomit, mucus, baldness, snogging and smoking. If you've ever wanted a tour around some of the least pleasant parts of your head, The Kingdom of Infinite Space is the book for you. Professor Tallis took Guardian science correspondent James Randerson on what he called a fantastical journey round your head and began by explaining why, for him, the brain is such a bit player.
Most people seem to think that the brain is the complete explanation of what we are, that our identity, our selfness, indeed our consciousness, is to be found in the isolated brain, and I don't think so. We've had lots and lots of headless brains, and this is a corrective, really. We've got a head in which the brain is not particularly represented.
Interesting. So the self that you're talking about is not just about what's going on in consciousness and within the grey matter, it sort of extends out into all these other functions of the head.
Yes, I mean, you say consciousness and within the grey matter, that presupposes that consciousness is located in the grey matter, and my own feeling is that consciousness isn't located in that sort of way. Clearly, we are embodied subjects, and being an embodied subject doesn't mean just being a brain or even just being a body. It means being a body in a material environment, but more importantly, relating to a community of minds that's been built up by millions of brains over hundreds of thousands of years.
Is that quite a controversial position? Because it seems to go against a lot of the popular science that's out there at the moment that really says, you know, it's the grey matter that matters, if you like.
It is, and it's getting more controversial as time goes on. It seems to me that the trend is increasingly to try and find bits of ourselves in bits of brains. You know, you'll find people saying, you see a bit of the brain that lights up on an MRI scan, and consciousness that corresponds to that stimulus is to be found in that lighting up. And you have claims that, you know, people now know what love is in neural terms, or, you know, what patriotism is in neural terms, and so on. It's a bit like the phrenology of the 18th century, only it's just got more expensive equipment.
So this is a sort of a fight against reductionism.
Absolutely.
In neuroscience.
Absolutely. Quite. Reductionism reduces us basically to a series of material processes. Material processes that are not particularly unusual. After all, an awful lot of neural activity occurs in the absence of consciousness or selfness. No one pretends for a moment that what happens in my spinal cord is part of myself, and yet it's the same sort of activity.
Another feature in the book that returns is this question of the self and where you reside, and, you know, it's pure philosophy, really. What is the conclusion of the sort of philosophical inquiry that runs through this book?
There are two sorts of conclusions. First of all, I don't think we can explain human consciousness in material terms, and in particular in relation to neural activity. And secondly, we must remember how different human consciousness is from animal consciousness. Human beings are knowing animals. They deal with propositions and abstract ideas. Animals basically are sentient, and their experiences are, as it were, wired into the material environment in which they have to survive.
There's a wonderful quote that you use in the book from Larkin: "Our flesh surrounds us with its own decisions," which seems to me that also taps into this idea of not this sort of pilot in the grey matter that's controlling everything, that things sort of happen around us, our hair grows, our tears well from our eyes, sometimes mucus comes from our nose. It's an interesting image that you conjure up there, I think.
I think that line from Larkin is brilliant. I think it captures our peculiar situation of being identified with our bodies, but at the same time being rather surprised, disappointed, frightened spectators of our bodies. An awful lot that our daily life depends on is not under our control at all. I mean, the healing of a wound. Something can happen to my hand and I can see the wound gets on with healing itself. I have absolutely no means of controlling it. I wouldn't even know how to do it. I couldn't even get my heart to beat if it didn't do it for itself.
So do you think that we have a kind of superiority complex in a way that we want to feel that we're in control of all these things, and we have to kind of slightly let go a little bit? I mean, partly as people, but also as scientists, and accept that these things aren't really under our control.
But a lot of things are. I mean, that's the surprising thing. It's extraordinary, given that our flesh surrounds us with its own decisions, how many decisions we do make, the extent to which we lead our lives rather than simply being led by the evolving organic processes of our bodies. And I think that is a rather remarkable thing. And it happens because we get our heads together. We collectively, as it were, gain some kind of purchase on our individual bodies.
There's also a lovely sort of interlude, a kind of sub-chapter on smoking, and you start that off with quoting Bob Newhart, who's this comedian talking about Sir Walter Raleigh trying to convince someone of the idea of smoking. And I remember listening to this as a kid, so it's brought back great memories for me. And then you move on to this sort of interlude about black and white film and the way smoking is so evocative and how it's a metaphor for time and things like that. It's quite nice to have something like that in a book about science, because there's, you know, there's not a great deal of science, if you like, in quotes, in that particular bit of the book. I mean, clearly you're trying to do more here than just, you know, educate people about science. There's a lot of poetry in this book as well. Was that a very conscious thing, or did it just sort of happen?
Very much so. And in fact, I'm really grateful for my publishers to allow my inner Martian to sort of follow the ideas where they took me. Smoking is very interesting. I mean, the Bob Newhart sketch is hilarious, you know. I don't think you're going to be able to sell people that idea of stuffing burning leaves in your mouth, Walt, sort of thing. And of course, how wrong could he be? 1.1 billion people are smoking even as we speak. I think it was Richard Klein said, you know, cigarettes are sublime. And a sort of awful way they are. They're a beautiful marker of the unfolding of time, marvellous punctuation marks of our daily round and so on. Just happened to kill people. But it was an opportunity when thinking about smoking absolutely to digress into all sorts of poetic flights of fancy.
Are you a fanatical about smoking because you're an ex-smoker?
No, I'm not an ex-smoker, but I've seen lots of people who are ex-smokers. They're called dead people.
Right. So you must be quite keen on the smoking ban.
For two reasons. For the general sort of public health reason, yippee, but also for the personal reason that an amazing number of pubs are now habitable that previously weren't.
There's another chapter. Well, I'll read the quote first. No orgasm, symphony or wartime briefing could be so all-consuming. Now, what you're describing there is vomiting. Beyond that, is quite a sort of graphic description of what happens when you vomit. And it struck me as I was reading it that I don't think I've ever read a chapter about vomiting before. That must have been quite fun to do.
I really enjoyed it. I mean, vomiting, first of all, is a good example of the flesh surrounding us, literally, with its own decisions. But it's such an awful thing that we make such marvellous jokes about it. I mean, I quote a joke I very much enjoy from Les Patterson, a.k.a. Barry Humphreys, describing Les Patterson crossing the Atlantic on a duty-free trip and vomiting copiously in the lap of a lady with a chihuahua. And as he's cleaning her up, he lifts up the chihuahua, which is still wriggling, and said, God, I don't remember eating that. And it just seems to me that captures the awfulness of vomiting.
Just moving on from the book now, I mean, one of the things that you've been a great campaigner for is the scientific method, good scientific data, evidence-based medicine, that kind of thing. You gave the Sense About Science annual lecture last year on those kind of topics. What's your reading of the situation with regards to alternative medicines, homeopathy, that kind of thing? It's a topic we come back to time after time on the podcast. It's great, great interest, I think, to listeners. And you know, there seems to be a growing feeling amongst scientists that actually we should speak out about this and call a spade. And when people are suggesting things that don't have any evidence to back them up, it's important that we let the public know. And there seems to be some evidence that the NHS, for example, NHS trusts are responding to this by funding these kind of treatments less and less. What's your reading of the situation? Do you think things are improving?
I think things are improving. For example, there were 5 homeopathic hospitals that were funded on the NHS. One has been closed down or at least no longer funded on the NHS, so it's 1 down, 4 to go. But why do we get such a state about it? People will say, fairly harmless, you know, if it makes patients feel good, what does it matter? Alternative practitioners can give the patients the attention that, you know, conventional practitioners don't have the time for and so on. Well, I think it's wrong for two reasons. One, I think it actually cons people. It tells them that they are receiving medicine that has specific effects, which it doesn't. And secondly, it actually mocks the achievements we've made in trying to bring medicine to being science-based and evidence-based. People forget how extraordinarily difficult it has been to arrive at a science-based medicine. You know, that represents a fantastic triumph for humanity, not only against nature, but against itself, against our tendency to con. So the idea we're going to regress back to medieval approaches to medicine is actually deeply ethically shocking.
I guess it's easy to measure the amount of money that the NHS, for example, is spending on something. But do you think wider than that, that there's a consciousness within the public now about the difference between science and non-science and pseudoscience? Or is there still a lot of confusion out there?
Well, I've been very encouraged by a couple of books that come out recently, one in particular by Simon Singh and Edzard Ernst, which have A, had a lot of publicity, and B, had a lot of favourable reviews. It's no longer seen as being closed-minded to oppose alternative medicine. It's actually standing up for rigour. Because that's one of the myths, that alternative practitioners are somehow more open-minded than conventional practitioners. But actually, when you look closely, they're extraordinarily narrow-minded. You know, acupuncturists have an acupuncture answer to every question, and they will not, you know, have a good word to say about homeopaths. Within orthodox medicine, we have a fantastic range of treatments for a wide variety of diseases. You know, you don't treat diabetes the same as you treat appendicitis.
Well, thank you very much indeed.
Thanks for the chance to be on the soapbox.
That was the scientist, philosopher and poet, Raymond Tallis. His book, The Kingdom of Infinite Space, A Fantastical Journey Around Your Head, is out now. For more news, interviews and analysis on science, technology, environment and medicine, make sure you listen to our Science Weekly podcast, available at guardian.co.uk/science or through iTunes.